He left the shirt on the floor and pulled at the waistband of his boxers and wriggled them down over his hips, stepped out of them and grasped the hem of his undershirt. This was the hardest part. He stretched the hem and ducked and whipped it up over his head, changed his grip to the neck and pulled it up over his face. He pulled it down on the right and eased his hook out through the armhole. Then he cracked his left arm like a whip until the undershirt came off it and landed on the floor. He bent and scooped it up with the shirt and the boxes and the socks and carried them into the bathroom and dumped them all in the basket. He walked naked back to the bed and sat down again on the edge, reached across his chest with his left hand, and unbuckled the heavy leather straps around his right bicep. There were three straps and three buckles. He eased the leather corset apart and squeezed it backward off his upper arm. It creaked in the silence as it moved. The leather was thick and heavy, much thicker and heavier than any shoe leather. It was built up in shaped layers. It was brown and shiny with wear. Over the years it had molded itself like steel to his shape. It crushed the muscle as he eased it back. He fiddled the riveted straps clear of his elbow, then he took the cold curve of the hook in his left hand and pulled gently. The cup sucked off the stump and he pulled it away, clamped it vertically between his knees, the hook pointing downward to the floor and the cup facing upward. He leaned over to his nightstand and took a wad of tissues from a box and a can of talc from a drawer. He crushed the tissues in his left palm and pushed them down into the cup, twisting the wad like a screw to wipe away the sweat of the day. Then he shook the can of talc and powdered all around the inside. He took more tissues and polished the leather and the steel, and he laid the whole assembly on the floor parallel with the bed. He wore a thin sock on the stump of his right forearm. It was there to stop the leather chafing the skin. It was not a specialist medical device. It was a child's sock. Just tubular, no heel, the sort of thing mothers choose before their babies can walk. He bought them a dozen pairs at a time from department stores. He always bought white ones. They were cheaper. He eased the sock off the stump and shook it out and laid it next to the box of tissues on the nightstand. The stump itself was shriveled. There was some muscle left, but with no work to do, it had wasted to nothing. The bones were filed smooth on the cut ends, and the skin had been sewn tight down over them. The skin was white and the stitches were red. They looked like Chinese writing. There was black hair growing on the bottom of the stump, because the skin there had been stretched down from the outside of his forearm. He stood up again and walked to the bathroom. A previous owner had installed a wall of mirror above the sink. He looked at himself in it and hated what he saw. His arm didn't bother him. It was just missing. It was his face he hated. The burns. The arm was a wound, but the face was a disfigurement. He turned half sideways so he didn't have to look at it. He cleaned his teeth and carried a bottle of lotion back to the bed, squeezed a drop onto the skin of the stump, and worked it in with his fingers. Then he placed the lotion next to the baby's sock on the nightstand and rolled under the covers and clicked the light off.
"Left or right?" Jody asked. "Which did he lose?"
Reacher was standing over Bamford's bright casket, sorting through bones. "His right," he said. "The extra hand is a right hand." Newman moved across to Reacher's shoulder and leaned in and separated two splintered shards of bone, each one about 5 inches in length. "He lost more than his hand," he said. "These are the radius and the ulna from his right arm. It was severed below the elbow, probably by a fragment of the rotor blade. There would have been enough left to make a decent stump." Reacher picked up the bones and ran his fingers across the splintered ends.
"I don't understand, Nash," he said. "Why didn't you search the area?"
"Why should we?" Newman said back neutrally.
"Because why just assume he survived? He was grievously injured. The impact, the severed arm... Maybe other injuries, maybe internal. Massive blood loss, at least.
Maybe he was burned, too. There was burning fuel everywhere. Think about it, Nash. Probability is he crawled out from the wreck, bleeding from his arteries, maybe on fire. He dragged himself 20 yards away and collapsed in the undergrowth and died. Why the hell didn't you look for him?
Ask yourself the question, Newman said. Why didn't we look for him?
Reacher stared at him. Nash Newman, one of the smartest guys he'd ever known. A man so picky and precise he could take a fragment of skull an inch wide and tell you who it had belonged to, how he had lived, how he had died. A man so professional and meticulous he had run the longest-lasting and most complicated forensic investigation ever known in history and received nothing but praise and plaudits all the way. How could Nash Newman have made such an elementary mistake? Reacher stared at him, and then he breathed out and closed his eyes.
Christ, Nash, he said slowly. You know he survived, don't you? You actually know it. You didn't look for him, because you know it for sure.
Newman nodded. Correct.
But how do you know?
Newman glanced around the lab, lowered his voice.
Because he turned up afterward, he said. He crawled into a field hospital 50 miles away, and 3 weeks later, it's all in their medical files. He was racked with fever, serious malnutrition, terrible burns to one side of his face, no arm, maggots in the stump. He was incoherent most of the time, but they identified him by his dog tags. Then he came around after treatment and told the story. No other survivors but himself. That's why I said we knew exactly what we were going to find up there. That's why it was such a low priority. Until Leon got all agitated about it.
So what happened? Jody asked. Why all the secrecy?
The hospital was way north, Newman said. Charlie was pushing south and we were retreating. The hospital was getting ready for evacuation.
And? Reacher asked.
He disappeared the night before they were due to move into Saigon.
He disappeared?
Newman nodded.
Just ran away. Got himself out of his cot and lit out. Never been seen since.
Shit, Reacher said.
I still don't understand the secrecy, Jody said.
Newman shrugged. Well, Reacher can explain it. More his area than mine.
Reacher still had hold of Hobie's bones, the radius and the ulna from his right arm, neatly socketed on the lower end like nature intended, savagely smashed and splintered at the upper end by a fragment of his own rotor blade. Hobie had studied the leading edge of that blade and seen that it was capable of smashing through tree limbs as thick as a man's arm. He had used that inspiration to save other men's lives over and over again. Then that same blade had come folding and whirling down into his own cockpit and taken his hand away.
He was a deserter, he said.
Technically, that's what he was.
He was a serving soldier and he ran away. But a decision was taken not to go after him. Had to be that way, because what could the army do? If they caught him, what next? They would be prosecuting a guy with an exemplary record. 991 combat missions, a guy who deserted after the trauma of a horrendous injury and disfigurement. They couldn't do that. The war was unpopular. You can't send a disfigured hero to Leavenworth for deserting under those circumstances. But equally, you can't send out the message that you're letting deserters get away with it. That would have been a scandal of a different sort. They were still busting plenty of guys for deserting, the undeserving ones. They couldn't reveal they had different strokes for different folks. So, Hobie's file was closed and sealed and classified secret. That's why the personnel record ends with the last mission. All the rest of it is in a vault somewhere in the Pentagon.
Jody nodded. And that's why he's not on the wall, she said. They know he's still alive.
Reacher was reluctant to put the arm bones down. He held them and ran his fingers up and down their length. The good ends were smooth and perfect,
ready to accept the subtle articulation of the human wrist. "Have you logged his medical records?" he asked Newman. "His old x-rays and dental charts and all that stuff?" Newman shook his head. "He's not MIA. He's survived and deserted." Reacher turned back to Bamford's casket and laid the two yellow shards gently in one corner of the rough wooden box. He shook his head. "I just can't believe it, Nash. Everything about this guy says he didn't have a deserter's mentality. His background, his record, everything. I know about deserters. I hunted plenty of them." "He deserted," Newman said. "It's a fact. It's in the files from the hospital." "He survived the crash," Reacher said. "I guess I can't dispute that anymore. He was in the hospital. Can't dispute that either. But suppose it wasn't really desertion. Suppose he was just confused or groggy from the drugs or something. Suppose he just wandered away and got lost." Newman shook his head. "He wasn't confused." "But how do you know that? Loss of blood, malnutrition, fever, morphine?" "He deserted," Newman said. "It doesn't add up," Reacher said. "War changes people," Newman said. "Not that much," Reacher said back. Newman stepped closer and lowered his voice again. "He killed an orderly," he whispered. "The guy spotted him on the way out and tried to stop him. It's all in the file. Hobie said, 'I'm not going back,' and hit the guy in the head with a bottle. Broke his skull. They put the guy in Hobie's bed, and he didn't survive the trip back to Saigon. That's what the secrecy is all about, Reacher. They didn't just let him get away with deserting. They let him get away with murder."
There was total silence in the lab. The air hissed, and the loamy smell of the old bones drifted. Reacher laid his hand on the shiny lip of Bamford's casket, just to keep himself standing upright. "I don't believe it," he said.
"You should," Newman said back, "because it's true."
"I can't tell his folks that," Reacher said. "I just can't. It would kill them."
"Hell of a secret," Jody said.
"They let him get away with murder."
"Politics," Newman said. "The politics over there stunk to high heaven. Still do, as a matter of fact."
"Maybe he died later," Reacher said. "Maybe he got away into the jungle and died there later. He was still very sick, right?"
"How would that help you?" Newman asked.
"I could tell his folks he was dead, you know. Gloss over the exact details."
"You're clutching at straws," Newman said.
"We have to go," Jody said. "We need to make the plane." "Would you run his medical records?" Reacher asked. "If I got hold of them from his family? Would you do that for me?" There was a pause.
"I've already got them," Newman said. "Leon brought them with him. The family released them to him."
"So will you run them?" Reacher asked.
"You're clutching at straws," Newman said again.
Reacher turned around and pointed at the 100 cardboard boxes stacked in the alcove at the end of the room. "He could already be here, Nash."
"He's in New York," Jody said. "Don't you see that?"
"No. I want him to be dead," Reacher said. "I can't go back to his folks and tell them their boy is a deserter and a murderer and has been running around all this time without contacting them. I need him to be dead."
"But he isn't," Newman said.
"But he could be, right?" Reacher said. "He could have died later. Back in the jungle, someplace else, maybe far away, on the run. Disease, malnutrition. Maybe his skeleton was found already. Will you run his records as a favor to me?"
"Reacher, we need to go now," Jody said.
"Will you run them?" Reacher asked again.
"I can't," Newman said. "Christ, this whole thing is classified. Don't you understand that?
I shouldn't have told you anything at all, and I can't add another name to the MIA lists now. The Department of the Army wouldn't stand for it. We're supposed to be reducing the numbers here, not adding to them." "Can't you do it unofficially, privately? You can do that, right? You run this place, Nash, please, for me?"
Newman shook his head. "You're clutching at straws, is all. Please, Nash," Reacher said.
There was a silence, then Newman sighed.
"Okay, damn it," he said. "For you, I'll do it, I guess."
"When?" Reacher asked. Newman shrugged. First thing tomorrow morning, okay? Call me as soon as you've done it? Sure. But you're wasting your time. At number?
Use the mobile, Jody said.
She recited the number. Newman wrote it on the cuff of his lab coat. Thanks, Nash, Beecher said. I really appreciate this.
Waste of time, Newman said again.
We need to go, Jody called.
Beecher nodded vaguely, and they all moved towards the plain door in the cinder block wall. Lieutenant Simon was waiting on the other side of it, with the offer of a ride around the perimeter road to the passenger terminals.